and welcome. You are listening to Research Period, a podcast about research about menstruation. My name is Lisa Smith, and I am your host for today's recording. We are recording virtually on Zoom via Douglas College, which is located on the unceded territories of the Kikite and Kukulcan First Nations. Even in the virtual realm, we need to continue to act in ways that move decolonization forward. And further connecting in these virtual spaces really pushes us to think about that work in new ways. And I look forward to carrying on with that conversation in subsequent episodes. Today, I am joined by Kate Elliott and Kevin Hebert from Changing the Flow. I am so grateful that you were able to make time to speak with me about your work, as well as the work of Changing the Flow. Welcome to you both.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Thank you, Lisa.
Getting started, I feel that listeners might like to know a bit more about you. And so I'm interested to know from each of you how you came to be involved in advocacy related to menstrual equity. Kate, would you be willing to start us off?
Yes, of course. So as Lisa introduced, my name is Kate Elliott and my pronouns are she, her. And I came to be involved in menstrual equity advocacy. I would say it wasn't a planned thing. I have always been passionate about feminist causes in a broad sense. And during my master's in anthropology, cultural anthropology, I started looking into the health of women experiencing homelessness in a very broad sense. And, you know, just in this introductory research, came across the idea of the homeless period, and I ended up volunteering for an organization that was targeting getting period products to people experiencing homelessness to help them manage their period. And this is how I met Kevin, and it really just took off from there, and it has just become so exciting. And I love menstrual equity because I think it does encompass so many different social justice components.
Yeah, it's so wonderful that you were able to find a pathway from your studies into something that really matters to you. That's exciting to me. And
definitely.
Kevin, what about for you? What was your journey into becoming an advocate for menstrual equity?
Thank you. Thank you very much, Lisa. It was, in hindsight, quite an ongoing, I guess, ever changing journey. But to summarize, I would say that as Kate mentioned, we came to know each other through volunteering, initially focused on addressing period poverty in our community. And as we did that work, I very naively, in hindsight, came to believe that the inequity that I was seeing was mainly due to simply a lack of awareness, particularly with non-menstruators, who, due to the taboo and their own ignorance, just didn't realize the harm caused. And I again stressed very naively in hindsight, thought that we just needed to bring this to the attention of folks in power and the problem would be solved. And quickly I realized that it's a much deeper problem, deeply rooted in misogyny, in my opinion. And that really struck a nerve. So in fact, that became the genesis for me in terms of making menstrual equity a full-time career at the moment.
Yeah, and quite different from Kate's journey, but you ended up in the same place, which is really wonderful to hear. Thank you so much to both of you for sharing a bit about your experience and what led you to do this work. I'm interested now if you can share with listeners a bit about the work of Changing the Flow. And I recognize this is challenging to do so in a brief space because you are doing so much, but perhaps one of you can get us started and the other can add anything that's missing. Kevin, would you like to start?
Sure. So Changing the Flow was, as I said, was born out of our desire to move beyond purely volunteering to address period poverty and really going to the root of of the inequities. So getting to achieve menstrual equity, and our goals are to destigmatize menstruation and normalize conversations around it. And a tangible example of that for us is that period products be free and accessible in every public and work washroom in Canada. And so we do a number of different initiatives centered around that, that I will pass the microphone to Kate to tell us about.
Okay, thank you. And please, if I miss anything, let me know. Wow. Okay. So what do we do? Well, I think a large part of what we see as a step towards getting period products in these washrooms is to destigmatize. And so, for example, we have an e-commerce store where we sell products that all have that intention of destigmatizing menstruation and starting conversations, however basic they may be, just to really combat the shame that menstruators can have around their period. And then we also just kind of take on whatever we can, I think, whether that be in webinars where we're looking to educate and spread awareness, which is something we've recently started up, and try to inspire more people to join the menstrual equity movement. We also have a product called Your Period Box, which is a container for your period products, which seems simple, but is somewhat revolutionary in the sense that people hide away their period products in their own house from guests, and in public or workplace washrooms, they're not even there. And so we have a product that's intended to make that statement that period products should be there exactly where you need them. And yeah, Kevin, I feel like there is so much more to add and I'm drawing a blank.
That's really great. Go ahead, Kevin. Yeah, please.
No, I was gonna, yeah, absolutely. Those are all great things. And we cannot forget the research, which is another key component of the work that we've done, and to all under that same umbrella of getting the awareness out there, destigmatize, and then advocacy. And the research piece is pretty huge, because the lack of data is often used as an excuse for inaction. And mm-hmm. So this is one way to counter that, by clearly pointing out the data exists and there's a problem.
I have to say, it's so impressive to hear you both speak, because I can really hear that you approach this in such a thoughtful way, and also that you're coming at this in a number of ways. And I feel like that's such an important way to explore what truly is a social issue. And I'm so glad you brought up the research piece, because that actually leads to my next question, because I understand that you have conducted some research recently and that took place within your community and it relates to the work that you're doing. I'm wondering, Kate, perhaps you can share a bit with me about this project and what it entails.
Yeah, so the research is entitled Menstruation in Waterloo Region, Insight into Experiences, Attitudes, and Advancements. And so this is a research project that we took on to be able to understand the kind of attitudes and awareness around menstruation and menstrual equity in Waterloo Region, where we are located. And so we believe that it's relevant outside of Waterloo Region, because there are many comparable locations. You know, this is a Canadian area, and so there's definitely national comparisons to be made. But equally, locally, we want to be able to have the data to present to people around us and say, look, this is the reality, and we have data to prove this now, and to hopefully start those conversations more, because it's just a fact that some people need statistics to be able to really think about something and comprehend it more, and to have that idea of one in four. Because, for example, one of the big takeaways that we got from this, that I think is the statistic most people have found interesting, is that one in four people have struggled to afford period products in mm-hmm. Waterloo Region. It's actually 26%, so slightly higher, and that's just out of our participant pool and by no means representative of all the different populations that we didn't include, based on the fact that we had an online data collection survey. We don't want to assume that we were really reaching people experiencing homelessness, for example, who may not have the same access to internet or even a device to do this, or people who are incarcerated. And I think that's a really important, not, I don't want to say error, but we don't have that information. And so the fact that there's 1 in 4, which is already surprising to me, who's involved in this work, you know, the reality is that number is higher.
Yeah, for sure. And we wouldn't be surprised to learn that. I think anyone working in this field knows that. And I'm so excited that you took this initiative within the context of your community. And I imagine as a researcher, there must have been all of these extra things that you saw that could become future research. And Kevin, Kate's already touched on that a bit, but when you think about the research, what kinds of things excite you about going forward that you'd really like to learn more about? What kinds of gaps do you see?
So it's fantastic the way that the initial research was done. It really sets the table for more digging, which is nice, because it's a standalone report that provides a snapshot of a point in time in our community. And you know, there's tangible data there, and as Kate mentioned, there's certain segments and certain pieces of information that we couldn't get in all in one initial survey. So the experience of people that menstruate that are incarcerated is a very important one that we call out, in fact, in terms of next steps for a call to action. People experiencing disabilities and other intersectionalities between menstruation and disabilities, for instance, are key. There's a lot more to it, so it's absolutely wonderful that we start and center in this case around menstrual equity. That doesn't look the same for every person, so we need to be very, very deliberate going forward that we take those all the different applications of what that can look like into consideration, and not perpetuate the harm by solving it for a segment of the population and then thinking we're done and people move on, even, you know, further harming those that don't get addressed. So that's a big piece.
Yeah, I think that, you know, this research is very much a launching pad for both ourselves and anyone else who wants to get on board, because the more research, the better. You know, as we said, we definitely didn't cover everything. This report is intended to be much more accessible to a layman audience who has never heard the term menstrual equity before. We want them to be able to understand it and take something from it and have a kind of toolkit to go and have those conversations and hopefully be inspired to, you know, push for change. And so there's definitely a lot that's missing, but it's still, I think, highlighting some important points. And, you know, for example, we had 85% of respondents had gotten their period at work when unprepared. And I think that that's a really important point, because we equate, and it's not always right to do so, but we do equate the idea of having employment as having more financial security. And so we're pointing to the fact that it's not about, like, finances are not the only barrier to period products. That 1 in 4 people have struggled to afford period products points to period poverty, but menstrual equity overall, you know, we had 95% of people have had to use a substitute in place of a period product. And clearly these numbers aren't aligning. And, you know, some people have never thought about that before, that there's more to this than a financial barrier, which is definitely an important thing to address completely. And, you know, one thing that I think we failed to mention as Changing the Flow is we have a donation program where we donate period products, because as much as it's important to work towards that long-term solution and the advocacy work that we do, there's also so many people right in this moment who just need a period product, and having that immediate support is really important in tandem, we think.
Yeah, for sure. And it's really exactly as you're saying, right? It's addressing that immediate need, but also keeping the eye on that long-term and deeper systemic change. And it sounds to me like you've already touched on this a bit, but it sounds like you feel that research has a place in that broader change. And I'm wondering if you can speak a bit about perhaps the findings from this study, or equally other kinds of research that you feel are needed to really bring that about.
Yeah, Kevin, do you want to take that one?
No, I want you to take it.
Okay, I'll start. Yeah, I think that, as I said, making this research accessible to a layman audience is really important, you know, and recognizing who we're reaching with it. This is, you know, public research that might be found via social media. And we want to make sure that someone who finds this on social media ideally is interested to read on and find the report. But even if they don't have necessarily a harmful view based on the statistic that they've seen. So that was a conscious decision when presenting it. And I think that it can definitely help inform broader change, and that hopefully it will inspire more research, both in ourselves and across different parts of Canada, for example, even just to have more to back up the same points. I think that's really important. Just to bring more people on board, because that's what's needed, people with the right motivations, I think. And there definitely needs to be more research going into policy and what that could look like, and potentially that is being done. There's a lot of move for policy, but I'm not sure if there's much research going into it. And I think that would be really helpful, because as it stands, our research report, kind of as Kevin mentioned, we have these calls to action at the end, but we're not relying on the policy. We're saying, because we didn't feel that the audience would, if we just told everyone reading it that the solution is that the government does something, then no one's going to do anything. Instead, yeah, we're saying that, you know, the local school boards need to take on the responsibility, and individual workplaces need to take on the responsibility, because eventually we believe that this will be mandated in some form of policy, but that doesn't mean you should wait until that time to start.
Yeah, no, that's so interesting. And if I can ask a follow-up there, Kate, I'm really interested to know what this experience was like compared to the work you did as a graduate student, right, where you were also doing research. So how was that experience for you? And if you can share a bit about that, that would be really interesting.
Yeah, it was definitely something that I think I struggled with, and definitely asked for Kevin's input a lot throughout, to sort of have this freedom of no ethics review board, for example, approving it, but obviously still wanting to use my training to make sure that the study is ethical, for example. Like that's really important to me. But being able to, you know, write it in a way that's accessible when there are a lot of complicated ideas in there, and knowing where to perhaps cut corners, for lack of a better term, on the information to be able to make this the kind of report that someone will read when they open it. I think we're at like 10 pages, for example. We don't want someone to be too intimidated. And I think, but you know, that even happens in academic work, that people will, you can't delve into every single aspect of a problem necessarily in one paper or one research report. And so I think that was definitely a big struggle for me, but it was so fun to feel like I could, you know, really use my academic background and training to make something that I believe is accessible to a higher degree than my master's thesis, for example.
Yes. And it's interesting to me because you really seem to have been able to focus in at the same time as an organization and as a group. You're just doing so much, which is really so inspiring. As a way to close, I'd be really interested to hear what it is that keeps you going, because I do truly feel that you're both doing so much. And Kevin, I'm interested to know what keeps you invested in this work.
Thank you. I guess I would try and summarize it. That could be the toughest one to summarize because it's literally the be all and end all in terms of what keeps me invested. I think calling is not too big a word. I think I'm going to go ahead and use the calling to justice from and through this work of menstrual equity. There are so many different ways that we can have meaningful, positive impact on the world, like right around us, so our own families, our children, our spouses, and then beyond broadly. And that's not something that you can necessarily always be in a position to do. So it's very, very meaningful in that sense. And I look specifically, for instance, to undergrad and graduate students that are perhaps struggling, as I think everybody does in those positions, of how do I take what I'm doing in academia or in the classroom, how does that get out into the real world? And or do I leave it behind and do something else? I mean, Kate just gave a beautiful case study of how to do it, but it is impressive because it's rare. But it's so meaningful to recognize that, you know, there's somewhat of a gap between those two worlds, but there needn't be. It's really something that we can kind of just put together, and people will, you know, the takeaway, I guess, that I would kind of conclude with is that it's that ability to make that change for the greater good that really pushes me. There's nothing, and maybe I'll share a slightly personal impression that sticks with me is Kate and I, early on in our work, we had been involved in some advocacy that did not produce a favorable outcome. We had a very, very small ask of a local city to provide period products in their washrooms. Their own staff recommended a pilot, even, which was just minuscule in cost, and it all got shot down and you know, almost pushed out the door as a non-starter. The pain I felt on behalf of an entire community of people who menstruate and people who will menstruate was deep. And what struck me as even more upsetting was Kate was with me, and she was more at peace with that decision than I was in her face. And that, it took me a moment to really, it took me some time to understand it. And we spoke, and that's a great thing that I've enjoyed with, that I enjoy with Kate, is that ability to share different experiences. But she was not as surprised and shocked as I was that it didn't go through. And I thought, there's something very, very wrong that our society is has created a level of acceptance to such misogyny and systemic misogyny, systemic pushing down of other people. And we kind of have created, you know, have allowed that to be okay. And it just, that bothered me so much. So I carry that rage on behalf of everybody else every day for that purpose of driving and hopefully using some of the privilege that I've been afforded as a non-menstruator and spread it back out to fix that injustice.
Well, that's certainly something to keep you motivated. And thank you so much for sharing that story. That's very powerful. Kate, what about for you? What keeps you going in this work?
Yeah, I think that the large scale, like what does menstrual equity actually look like, you know, globally for everyone, for every person, I think is very overwhelming. And I can't quite you know, grasp it. Like that is not my daily motivation. It's instead just kind of people around me, like interactions that I'll have with people, maybe new or not, where they're comfortable talking to me about menstruation, whether they menstruate or not, and I can kind of get a sense of like, oh, like they don't just do this with anyone, like they do it with me because they know that I'm cool to talk about periods with. They can do that, and I think that really is the main thing for me, because I guess it's seeing that payoff of the work that we do, that there is this immediate comfort around periods, which is just kind of a baseline, and it's not a given for a lot of people, you know, in the world or in Canada, that they feel that comfort. And so when people feel comfort with me, I'm really grateful, and it sort of reminds me then and there why, kind of part of why we do what we do. And then obviously there's moments of just like such joy and inspiration when, for example, Scotland passed their legislation. You know, that's a real push, and like, okay, like stuff is happening, like that could happen here, we have to keep doing it. But that's more of a maybe a monthly motivation where I have that wind where I feel like I can even grasp the idea of like a structural change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wonderful. Well, thank you to both of you so much. I'm just so grateful that you found space and time for this in your very busy and full schedules. And you heard it here, periods are normal. That's the catchphrase for changing the flow. And I just can't wait to see what's next for you both. Once again, thank you to Kate. Thank you to Kevin for being here with us today.
Thank you.
Thanks.
All right, well, that's all for today. And I hope to hear from or see you next time on Research Period.